And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens on this Friday, October 16th. I am Marc-Antoine Godin alongside Arpin Basu, as usual. How are you, my friend? Are you holding up?
Yeah. Now, the one thing I'm holding up just in the knowledge that Marc Bergevin said, he said on Thursday that he's taking a little break. So I am holding him to that. If he does anything this weekend, I will lose my mind and I will get angry at him. Just so he knows, my wrath is waiting. If I don't have the weekend without having to jump on my computer real fast and do a story and make my old story, make the story I just wrote completely invalid, I'll be annoyed. But if he holds to it, I'm doing well.
I've read some comments on social media this week saying, oh, you guys, your articles become so obsolete. They become obsolete so quickly because of Burge's, you know, crazy pace of
Well,
action.
Yeah. Well, that's because...
So it's hard to keep up with everything that's been going on. And that holds true for the podcast.
And I did. I had a bit of a meltdown online when I wrote that Jake Allen story and thinking that was the news of the day. And then, you know, an hour after it gets published, Brendan Gallagher signs and all the cap numbers that I had used in the story become obsolete. And I had an all caps meltdown on Twitter. So I think that might be where some of that is coming from. But
the points you made regarding Jake Allen though are still valid despite the Brendan Gallagher signing. And I think that Marc Bergevin pretty much, validated all the arguments that you brought forward, mentioning, for example, the fact that the crop of free agent goalies next year is extremely weak. The Canadiens would have been unlikely to find an interesting backup in that lot had they chosen to move away from Jake Allen. And there's also the fact that they don't seem, and by they, I mean not only Marc Bergevin, but Stéphane Waite too, don't seem to think that it would be entirely beneficial for Caden Primeau to step into the backup job as soon as next season. Well, next season, 21-22.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. You know, I mean, I think the one mistake that everyone, and we do the same thing with Jesperi Kotkaniemi, I think, but, you know, because Caden Primeau turned pro at such a young age, you assume, okay, he will have been in the AHL for 2 years at that point. 2 years in the AHL should be enough, but then you forget, oh, he's only 22. He will only be 22 by the time Jake Allen's current contract expires. So, 22-year-old goaltenders, it's only really the exceptional ones who play in the NHL at age 22. The most goalies don't reach the NHL until age 24 or even 25. So, keeping Caden Primeau in the AHL until age 24, which is how old you'll be when Jake Allen's extension expires, would not be some sort of, you know, heinous act of cruelty to a young prospect. I think it could only benefit him, especially if Laval can have some success with him in the net. But in any case, this is just one small piece of the puzzle that Marc Bergevin has put together. over the last 6 weeks. And I think, you know, I was joking about it, but the sense of finality of Marc Bergevin's availability on Thursday struck me a little bit, in the sense that he really did seem like a man who was done, and he was satisfied with his work in the offseason. He was ready to let the dust settle and reevaluate what's going on. And, you know, his old line that we're always open, we're 7-11, blah, 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 is usually a sign that he doesn't intend on that. It's usually a sign like, give me a call if you want, but I won't be calling you. Like, I'm going to go take it easy for a bit. So I think it's a good time to let's look at his moves as a whole, because the one thing, you know, and I sent you this quote and we laughed about it, but, you know, Craig Custance, who always has these great, you know, little anonymous quote stories on getting people's opinions from around the hockey world. Well, he did a really extensive one where he collected comments on every single team in the NHL. And if you haven't read it, I would encourage you to go check it out, because there's just interesting tidbits on every team. And there was one quote on the Canadiens that I found very, very apt, or just it just made sense. It spoke to me, because it's often been how I've felt about what Marc Bergevin does, except I don't feel that way this time, and that's why I found it weird that he do it. And essentially, I'm going to paraphrase it to go quicker, but basically what the commenter was saying was that, individually, I like a lot of Montreal's moves, and I feel they have a lot of good players, but I don't feel how I fail to see how it all comes together. I fail to see how all the moves fit together and how the players fit together. I don't know if there's much of a plan there. That's paraphrasing. That's not a direct quote, but
he says I don't know what they're trying to do on a macro level. Sense.
And I've often felt that way. You know, I've often felt like Marc Bergevin, a move comes across his desk, he likes it in a vacuum and wouldn't take the time to think of how it fits with his team. That's what I thought in the past. But I got to say, this year, that quote, I don't feel like it really fits what Marc Bergevin has done. I felt like he, and you don't have to agree with the plan necessarily, not you personally, but people in general don't have to agree with the plan. But I feel like there was a clear and identifiable plan. There were specific roles that Marc Bergevin sought to fill in free agency and on the trade market, and methodically, one by one, went about doing that. You know, I mean, and when he talked about the four boxes that he needed to check off, I thought it was a very lucid way to go about his offseason. Like, identify roles on your team that need to be filled, and then go out and fill them. And he did that. And so, to me, I felt like this was the most coherent, this was the most macro offseason Marc Bergevin has ever had.
Yeah, I think that what helps making sense of all the moves that he made is the fact that they're targeted at the shorter term. I mean, they're meant to have an impact as soon as next season. So it's not like some big long-term plan that can, you know, somewhere along the lines fall short or be sidetracked by something else. It seems as though there are the needs that he had identified have been solved in order to make the Montreal Canadiens a much better team as soon as next season. So that's a lot easier to understand and to digest. And those four boxes, for those who had not identified them by now, obviously he wanted to upgrade his backup goaltender. He wanted to add its size and toughness on the back end without sacrificing mobility. He wanted to add a power forward, and he wanted to add goal scoring. So all those boxes have been ticked with Jake Allen, respectively, Joel Edmondson, Josh Anderson, and Tyler Toffoli. But what I find interesting is that not only does it serve the short term, but in the meantime, he has not used any of his prospects or given any high draft picks in order to achieve his goal. So in that sense, if he's able to maintain the salary cap sanity that he's looking for, and I think that he's walking on eggshells a little bit right now in that department, I think that if he managed to stay under the cap and find clever ways to get out of it, this is something that's going to be not only have a positive impact on the Canadians, on the team as soon as next year, but it can have a prolonged effect for 3, 4, or 5 years until we get into a territory where guys like Anderson and Gallagher, their respective contribution could start to diminish. Shea Weber's contribution could start to diminish. Same for Price. But in the meantime, you've got those I won't call it a window because I know he doesn't believe in it. But I think that there's an interesting number of years that the Canadiens can really be a competitive team. They're not a perfect team by any means, but I mean, you cannot look at this team and say, oh, no, they haven't improved, because they have.
Yeah, not only that, but I also think, like, you know, I think I heard a lot, I saw a lot of comments, well, not a lot, but I saw some people commenting on the Canadiens offseason being like, how did Mark Bergevin manage to spend all that money and not add a single star player? And that's fair. You know, Tyler Toffoli's a very good player. I wouldn't call him a star, but he's a 20-goal scorer, and he can score, but he's never put up, he's never in the scoring leaders. Josh Anderson, same thing, has had one 27-goal season and is on an upward progression, and I think, I honestly think he's, his ceiling is not star player. His ceiling is very unique, highly effective, very good player, you know, kind of thing. And so I think that comment is fair in a sense, but what really has to happen for the Canadiens, and this has always been true, is that their star players need to be the players that they drafted over the last three drafts. You know, like their star players need to be Nick Suzuki, Kotkaniemi, Romanov, Caulfield, Yolonen, whoever. Like all these, you need some of these players, a few of them at least, let's say two of them, to emerge as star players. At whatever position, but that's where the star power of the Canadiens will one day come from. Not superstar, but just be like really, really solid stars, you know, that can kind of drive the bus. And now there's all these pieces around that can sort of augment that or supplement that, in the sense that, you know, what Mark Bergevin has done this offseason is he's acquired, you know, not so much Joel Edmondson, but in Josh Anderson and Tyler Toffoli, and in re-signing Brendan Gallagher, what he's done is securing really high-end complementary players, like star complementary players, if you will, in the sense that, you know, if you do happen to have a super talented young centerman, you have now given, and the Canadiens have two of them, now who knows if either of them will become stars, but you've at least given those two guys the tools in terms of line mates to go out and succeed. And I think that's what Mark Bergevin's, part of the unsaid part of Mark Bergevin's offseason is something that struck me when he said it in Toronto immediately after the Canadiens were eliminated. And he was talking about Suzuki and Kotkaniemi, and he said, I am confident that we can build a team around these two young players. That's what he said. And it was the first time I'd ever heard Mark Bergevin say the words building around, which was not in reference to Carey Price and Shea Weber. Like that was the first, and to me that was kind of a shift. And I feel like, you know, Carey Price and Shea Weber are obviously still there, and they're still the heart of they're still the leaders of the team, and they're still the backbone and soul of the team, if you will. But there's clearly, I feel like Mark Bergevin has tried to lay the groundwork for all these kids that he's drafted, for them to enter the NHL in a winning environment, in an environment where they won't be heavily leaned on too early, and an environment where they can ultimately grow into starring roles. And I think that's actually a smart way to go about it. It's the advantage of his reset over the rebuild that we've talked about ad nauseum, and that we've had a lot of debate on. But when you do a rebuild, generally speaking, your young players get thrown to the wolves and you say, okay, go out. You're going to be given a prominent role. You might struggle for a bit, but in the end, it'll be good for you. I feel like he's trying to avoid doing that with some of his moves this offseason.
Yeah, I think that it's the right way to go about it to help Suzuki and Kotkaniemi develop. That being said, there's no certainty that these guys are going to turn into stars or even superstars. But when I hear or read fans that say, oh, well, the Canadiens then go get a superstar, and that if they were not to get one of Taylor Hall or Patrick Laine, it would be a failed offseason. I think that it's a bit of a lure to just think of those guys and say, well, these these named players are the ones that are going to take us to the promised land, especially a guy like Taylor Hall, who's barely ever played in the playoffs,
yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So if the Canadians, for example, there's a superstar player who's available on the market, Johnny Gaudreau. But had the Canadians traded for Johnny Gaudreau, would he have had a positive impact or filled any needs on this team? I don't think so. So it's just there's a wow factor that's missing to all those acquisitions. I agree with that. So, but at the same time, will it make it any less effective? I'm not so sure. I think that those are smart acquisitions. I still have my doubts regarding Joel Edmondson. I will wait until I see a bunch of games, how he adapts to the style of the Montreal Canadiens before really making my mind on this acquisition. But for the rest, I think those are savvy moves, are interesting prices that were paid, especially in the case of Toffoli. I'm coming around also on Jake Allen's extension. So I think the Canadiens are a better team, and it's not a failure to not go after after Taylor Hall. I mean, if the Canadiens had spent so much money on Taylor Hall and after a single year he'd be gone, in the process you would have potentially put all your salary structure in shambles for one season. You put all your eggs in a basket. And then if it doesn't work, if you don't retain the guy for a long period of time, then, you know, you start from scratch a year from now. It was probably better to go after players that you could secure for more than 1 year and try to build something coherent out of it.
Yeah, not only that, but like Taylor Hall's number right now is $8 million. So to sign him long term, you're talking about a number that's in the tens. You know, I mean, it's like it's really... You have to wonder if, and this is where I find a lot of what's going on very interesting, is that, you know, Taylor Hall has slowly built up to being, you know, eventually probably next year, if not, you know, at least a $9 million player as of next year. What Mark Bergevin is clearly concerned about, because he's vocalized it on numerous occasions throughout this offseason, is that eventually his own guys, his own young players will need to get paid. And you look at it, Jesperi Kotkaniemi is RFA in 2021. Nick Suzuki is RFA in 2022, as is Alexander Romanov. Though Romanov is not eligible for an offer sheet, so there's not really a threat of losing him. But still, if he performs over the next two seasons, if Suzuki performs over the next two seasons, those could potentially be expensive contracts. Now, with the salary structure the way it is, you know, it's becoming more and more likely that these guys, all three of these guys, will wind up getting bridge deals. And honestly, we don't know what Romanov is going to look like in the NHL yet, but you know, the Canadians seem pretty high on him, so we're going to give them the benefit of the doubt there. But if everything goes according to plan and these three young players perform to what appears to be the expectation in the Canadians' brain trust, they will cost a lot of money. Excuse me. They will cost a lot of money much sooner than used to be the case. You know, I mean, just this is the reality in the NHL now. Is, you know, coming out of entry level, you can strike it rich right away. So, it's. I thought it was very telling that, especially when it pertains to talking about Philip Deneau's contract, that Mark Bergevin's emphasis was, we're not going to lose Kotkaniemi or Suzuki or Romanov on my watch. And that was his answer to a question about Philip Deneau, who is like not just some random player, is a pretty important player on this team and is a pretty damn good player. And the priority now, money-wise, appears to be focused on keeping not only those three that I mentioned, but a lot of the other younger players that are in the pipeline and making their way to Montreal, because those guys are going to need to get paid eventually as well.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. you can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
We'll get to Philip Deno in just a little while. I just wanted to play devil's advocate for 1 second and wrap up on Taylor Hall signing for 1 year in Buffalo. Those who would have been proponents of him signing even just for 1 year in Montreal could easily argue, say, listen, the Canadiens went on to sign Joel Edmondson for $3.5 million a year and later on Tyler Toffoli at $4.25. Wouldn't you be better off with Taylor Hall, albeit for 1 year, and continue to trust Brett Kulak as a top six defenseman for the same price as switching to Edmondson and Toffoli?
Yeah, you could make that argument, but my counter argument would be that what happens the year after? I mean, the long term benefit of the same question though, you could flip and say, okay, if they did that, are they a Stanley Cup contender? I'd say no. I mean, they could win the Stanley Cup. It's possible. I wouldn't put them in contender status. I wouldn't put them in contender status right now, but I wouldn't put them in contender status.
No, that's it. They're not in any of those scenarios.
Exactly. So with that being the case, is it not better to get the guy who you can get at a good number for more years where you can hopefully grow into a contender, Stanley Cup contender, and that goes first by making the playoffs 1 year, winning some playoff series, getting some experience and getting some confidence in your ability to win at playoff hockey. And then eventually, you know, I mean, look at the Tampa Bay Lightning. It's 2015, they made the final. They were young. They were talented. Everyone thought this is the start of a dynasty. It took them 5 years to get back to the Stanley Cup final and finally win it. But it was a long process, you know? And so it doesn't happen overnight. And so it's to me, there's very little benefit to adding Taylor Hall for 1 year. It really didn't make a whole lot of sense. You could easily make the argument that they should not have signed Edmondson and should have trusted Kulak in their top four, and they would have been fine. I can buy that argument. I don't necessarily disagree with it. I'd like to give Edmondson a chance and see how he fits in and see how he performs. And there's no doubt. The Canadiens' defense is now big and yeah. Mean. Like it's a bit. And when Brendan Gallagher said there aren't too many forward groups who are going to enjoy playing the Canadiens, I can see that. That's clear. That's to me. That's definitely the what's become the identity of the Canadiens' defense corps is that. Is even Romanov can be has a nasty edge to him at times. You know, so he's not a big guy. But he can play a physical style of game and is an excellent skater. And so this is what he's identified as what he wants out of his defense group. I think Marc Bergevin sees how a defense like that can be effective in the playoffs. A defense group like the St. Louis Blues had 2 years ago, of which Joel Edmondson was a part. So, yeah, I mean, I just feel... I think the idea of Taylor Hall is far more attractive than Taylor Hall himself. Like, you look at Taylor Hall's numbers, are they that much better than Tyler Toffoli's? Like, in terms of scoring goals? I don't know. They're not They're not that much better.
They're certainly not that much better than Brendan Gallagher's numbers.
No. And Tyler Toffoli's, he's right there. You know, he scores in the mid-20s pretty consistently, year after year. And so, you know, do I prefer... I mean, Taylor Hall's obviously a better player. He's a lot faster. He's more dynamic. He's got a Hart Trophy under his belt, and he's a player that you have to game plan for. And I don't know if you necessarily have to game plan for Tyler Toffoli, but opposing coaches, you know, Taylor Hall's name comes up when an opposing coach is preparing his team to play whatever team Taylor Hall happens to be on at that year. In that sense, he's a weapon, and he's he's worth the added investment, but is he worth a whole other player? Like, I mean, in terms of, like, if I'm comparing him and Toffoli just one-on-one, yeah, Taylor Hall is better, but he's not that much better. Like, he's not a whole Joel Edmondson better than Tyler Toffoli. You know what I mean? So, So yeah, I don't know.
But I think that when it comes to other teams preparing for the Montreal Canadiens, what they'll have to prepare next year is a team that is going to come at them four lines deep and who's going to, you know, the Canadiens were looking all this time to roll their lines the way that they were preaching the last couple of years, but now they gave themselves the means to do that properly by loading up on the right wing to properly serve their three main centermen. And even using one of their former top nine guys on the fourth line, whether it be Joel Armia or Arturi Lehkonen, most possibly Paul Byron, depending on what will happen to him. So this all of a sudden becomes a very deep team who shows up front maybe not a very high ceiling, but definitely a high floor. And I think that, you know, for all the discussions we've had over time regarding this team being built more as a weak link team than a strong link team, maybe they haven't shied away from that yet. But definitely they've tried to raise the floor and make sure that they've got much better bottom six, and they turn out to have three second lines. They're not three third lines. They're definitely three second lines. And I think that in today's NHL, there's something to be said about having so much balance. And that same balance is echoed on the blue line. When you have a guy like Brett Kulak, who had tremendous playoffs, if season was to start now, he would either be your number six or number seven defenseman. So there's depth up front, there's depth in the back, there's depth in the net. I mean, it's an attractive team as far as I'm concerned.
Can we take a moment and think of Claude Julien right now and just think of how happy he is? Claude Julien, somewhere in, you know, New Hampshire or wherever his off-season home is. I'm sure you're listening, Claude, because I know that you're a very ardent listener of the podcast, and I'm happy for you. You know, you've been screaming from the rooftops since you arrived in Montreal that you would like to have a team that Marc-Antoine just described. And here you go. You have it, finally. And so I am very eager to see how this system works with the players that they have. And that's why when I mentioned that this was the most coherent, most macro offseason Marc Bergevin has had, I really feel like he went out and got players that fit the way the Canadiens play. And that's important to me. You know, like, the Canadiens, to exit their zone, the Canadiens rely on their forwards perhaps more than any other team. They don't actually, their defense rarely skate the puck out of their own end. Their defense come back very deep in their own end and they skate it out. So that's why I feel the priority was to add defensemen who can kill plays, as Claude Julien likes to say, who can win battles, who can create, you can change possession and get the puck on their sticks and off their sticks as soon as possible into the forward's hands so that they can leave the zone and head the other way. And so that's why I feel the Canadiens would value someone like Joel Edmondson more than someone like Brett Kulak, let's say. And then, and now, you know, you have Paul Byron as a really high end fourth line player. If Arturi Lehkonen winds up on the fourth line, you have the epitome of just a perfect fourth line player, in the sense, like, I mean, you know, I think that a lot of the heat that Arturi Lehkonen took is because he was often in a top six role, you know, sometimes top nine, but he was often playing, you know, his most common line mate the last couple of years was Max Domi, you know, and so it was like, you can't have him in a role like that and have him not put the puck in the net more often than he did, even though I feel like his numbers are not as bad as people like to say they are, but he really, you know, when you have guys like that, or Joel Armia, or whoever, and if it's Jake Evans in the middle there, like, having a fourth line, if Arturi Lehkonen winds up on the fourth line, and Claude Julien, he's Claude Julien's favorite player, like, will he have any hesitation to put the fourth line out in any situation? I don't think he will. And so cheers, Claude Julien. And congratulations to you, because it's really a good thing for you that you finally have the team that you wanted, and now the onus is on you to kind of go out and use it to its full potential and see what the system can do with a team that was built to play it.
You know what's ironic, though? The Canadians have been for many years identified as primarily a fast team, and right now the main guys that we identify as potential cap casualties to make sure the Canadians go under the cap are Paul Byron, Victor Mete, and Brett Kulak. All three guys that bring speed to this lineup. Uh-huh. So if they were to subtract one or two of those guys, it would reduce the overall speed of this team. So there is a certain shift that's happening. You know, it was interesting yesterday. Marc Bergevin, during his Zoom conference, said, we used to be only a fast team, and now we can beat you in many ways. So they're not just a fast team anymore, but they could have some of their elements of speed, deducted from that lineup just for salary cap measures. So I think it's going to be interesting to see, because this remains a reality that the Canadians have to go under the cap. I'm not sure if sending Jordan Weal to Laval is going to cut it. There might be more money to be moved for that to happen. But I don't know. How do you think they'll go about it to clear the proper amount of money? Do you think that Paul Byron is indeed the one that's most likely to go?
Well, it's going to be hard to move him, right? I mean, it's Marc Bergevin is going to have to make the decision whether that is what's needed. I personally, it's the length of Paul Byron's contract that makes him probably most susceptible to moving and makes him most difficult to move. A 3.4 cap hit for the next three seasons. It's tough, even though he's kind of a proven 20 goal scorer. He's an excellent penalty killer. He checks a lot of boxes. But I feel like Bergevin would have to add a sweetener in there to move him. Perhaps someone like Victor Mete. Who knows? I mean, I'm not sure. I don't think right now. I think right now they feel like they can do some things that allow them to be cap compliant. And that includes carrying maybe one extra, two extras. I mean, it really, you know, they could have a 20-man roster next year. I mean, the beauty of having Laval right there is if anything happens to come up on a game day, they just call the guy up and he's, you know, depending on what traffic is like in Montreal, they can get there pretty quickly, you know? So it's like, yeah, it's an interesting, I think that's kind of the way they're going to do it. I think Jordan Weal, there's no doubt that he's going to wind up in Laval next year. Unfortunately for him, but that adds again to the depth that the Canadiens have. You know, I mean, last year when Drouin and Byron went down in mid-November, you know, the guys that were being called up were not necessarily NHL players. And I think Jordan Weal has a lot of faults, but he's an NHL player. You know, he can play in the NHL. He has certain skills that allow him to get into the lineup. And if you have him waiting in Laval, then you're that much better. If Ryan Poehling doesn't crack the top 12 forward-wise, having him be a healthy scratch serves no purpose to him. So he could wind up in Laval, and that's a good... But in terms of cap compliance, I think that's going to be the strategy. Is you shed Wheels $1.4 million, and that gets you to a manageable number. And then you just limit the number of extras you carry. And I think there might be one extra D-man, just because they'd be afraid of losing someone on waivers like a Mete or a Kulak, and one extra forward, and that's it. And even then, you don't even have to have the extra. I think it's just going to be a tightrope, and I think you're going to see a lot of people getting sent down to Laval and brought back up, and like there's going to be this sort of daily cap management. You know, John Sedgwick's going to become a very important, he's already a very important person in the front office, but John Sedgwick, who handles the Canadiens cap issues, is going to become all the more valuable because, you know, they had this huge cushion for years, which they still managed quite meticulously. But that management's going to have to get a lot more detail oriented and a lot more difficult in next season for sure. And in the coming seasons, probably just because, yeah, it's going to be tough. They've spent a lot of money and there's a lot of there's going to be a lot of gymnastics that are going to need to be done.
I wonder, though, if they wouldn't be able to kill two birds with one stone by trying to move some salary, but in return, going to get a defenseman on the third pair to whom there's 1 year left to his contract. And let me explain myself on that. It's just that Alexander Romanov will be coming in. They might ask him to play on the right side if they'd rather play Kulak on the left side next to him. But otherwise, Romanov will be paired at his right with necessarily another young defenseman, whether it be Mete, Cale Fleury, or Noah Jolson. And I wonder if by moving some salary beyond, in Barron's case, that's beyond next season, but in return for a third pairing defenseman whose contract is up at the end of next year, that way it could serve two purposes. You could just get rid of some money over longer term, but also enable Romanov to transition to the North American game a bit more easily, being on his natural side, on his strong side, and having a guy. And for example, it's just on top of my head, a guy like Ian Cole, for example, in Colorado, he's got 1 year left, $4.25 million. I think that's the sort of guy. If the Canadians were to make one more move before saying, okay, we're completely done until season starts, that's something I would not necessarily be opposed to.
Yeah, no, me neither. That would be ideal. But again, I mean, where's that? How would they do that? I don't see how they could add that. That would be really luxury. Like, that would be ideal. And actually, you know, in retrospect, I guess, yeah, instead of Edmondson, you would have someone there to play with Romanov in that sense. Like, that right. Money would be allocated to that position. I think they're kind of willing.
But we'll see. Edmondson says that he played on the right side quite a bit in St. Louis. But their intention seems to be for him to play alongside Petrie. So
that's it. He's in the top four for now.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe ultimately, I think that's kind of the wild card here, is that if Edmondson winds up moving to Romanov's right and they keep Kulak with Petrie, let's say, then that's looking a lot more feasible. But yeah, I agree. Like, Romanov could use someone next to him to talk to between shifts and to talk to on the bench and to just explain things as games go on. You know, Luke Richardson is really great for that, but having a D partner who can do that is really important. And I think the one this just came to me, actually. So sorry, I'm going on a bit of a tangent, but the one possibility that no one's really discussing here is that Romanov winds up playing with Weber, like Mete did a few years ago. And that they put him with Weber for that purpose, to acclimate him to the NHL and to give him the best, the way Claude put it that year, to give him the best possible chance of succeeding. And then you could play Sherratt with a young defenseman, or you could play Edmondson with a young defenseman on the third pairing, play Sherratt with Petrie, and things look a lot more balanced, you know, and maybe that's the way they go. And the more I talk about it, because I actually hadn't thought about it until right this very second, the more I talk about it, the more I kind of like that idea.
Yeah, well, it would probably balance the pairings more evenly. But at the same time, I think that they really liked what Sherratt and Weber did together. The metrics were not always favorable to them, but the end results were awful.
I know. The metrics were awful. I think
the image or the end result in their mind was very positive, because even Marc Bergevin used the expression "big three" the other day. So
I know, but I feel like that's something that, like, in the playoffs, that works. Like, when you're facing the same opponent over and over again, like, I feel like that's a very playoff tailored pairing. And I know they played a lot of the regular season last year, but their regular season in the regular season they struggled. Like they really did. And it's they gave up a lot of goals. Like, I mean, it's not even advanced metrics. It's goals for and goals against. I mean, it's really that simple. Like it's the metrics themselves didn't look good. But, you know, Claude Julien looks at plus minus. Like he likes that as a statistic. I don't hold it against him, but he does. And just from that very basic statistic, they were not good together last year. They gave up more goals than the Canadiens scored when they were on the ice. So I don't know, something worth considering. But I do want to get back to the Philip Deneau situation because, you know, we're running out of time and I think I don't want
to.
Maybe not. But like, I think we don't want to overinterpret what happened, what Marc Bergevin said or didn't say about Philip Deneau. He is presumably at some stage of negotiation with him. To our knowledge, those negotiations haven't really started yet. He gave the impression that they're not going to start anytime soon. He deflected questions on his importance and talked about the importance of getting guys like Kotkaniemi and Suzuki and Romanov signed. There's a lot of when he was asked about Deneau, he mentioned, but you know, we drafted Ryan Poehling. He's a centerman. We have Jake Evans. He's a center. Like he just seemed to constantly be trying to give the impression that they have other options aside from signing Philip Deneau. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that mainly he wants to squeeze Deneau into a number that will make him palatable for the salary cap beyond next season. I think that it's a negotiation ploy. Uh-huh. It's not that Marc Bergevin doesn't like Philip Deneau. I think that he sees him on his team for a long time. But when he said, when Bergevin said a few days ago that he needed some of his players, if they were interested in playing for the Montreal Canadiens, he needed them to make some sacrifices, I think that it was directly targeted at Philip Deneau. Mm-hmm. Now, right now, in the current state of negotiations, Philip Deneau can say, I've been the number one centerman of this team for the last two seasons, and I want to be paid accordingly. Maybe not like a top flight first line centerman, but I want to be paid like the most important centerman on this team. If the Canadiens choose to wait and this next season just plays out, then over the course of next season, I presume that if Suzuki and or Kotkaniemi continue with their development, at some point next season, Philip Deneau's place on the depth chart might change a little bit. His relative importance to the team might not. He might still face top opposition, might still play 18 minutes a night. That's fine. But his relative his place in the depth chart might move. And if the Canadiens as a team have success under those conditions, and he's relocated to a little bit more of a secondary role, then the Canadiens could say, look, here's on the long term what we envisage for you. Here's the spot that we would like to give you, and we will give you a price that fits with that role. And what he would lose in terms of AAV, in terms of annual compensation, he could gain it back with term, because this is a player that I think a lot more than Gallagher or Josh Anderson, I don't think that signing Philip Deneau long-term is any source of concern whatsoever. This is a guy that you could sign for 6 years at a very palatable number, and he's going to be a luxury third-line center for you. So they'll say, yeah, of course, it's a luxury, but I think that the best teams in the NHL and the ones that are most likely to go far in the playoffs have a strong third line. And if you have one of the best third line centermen in the league, it means that you're well equipped to go far in the playoffs. So I think that by just letting that season play out, it will either it will bring Deneau to his senses saying, okay, maybe I should readjust my expectations, especially after looking at what this free agent market just provided to other players, or he will stick to his guns. And if he does, well, he'll shop his services somewhere else.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Yeah, but I agree with everything you said. And I think the benefit of playing out next season is exactly that, is to show Dano what his future role on this team might be. Eventually over the course of the season, I honestly think he'll still be the first line center in training camp. But as the season goes along, he'll probably be giving up more and more space to Nick Suzuki, less so Kotkaniemi, but I think, you know, Suzuki, if he winds up playing on a line with Drouin and Anderson, will start to take up more and more of that responsibility. My thing is, what is that number that Bergevin is trying to squeeze him into? Because right now he makes a shade over $3 million a year.
Yeah.
To me, I think Bergevin is looking for a number that starts and ends at four, like four flat, which is only a $1 million a year raise, which under the current economic circumstances is not all that unreasonable. But as a UFA in the prime of his career, as a centerman who is in the conversation for the Selke Trophy, that's an attractive piece to shop on the UFA market. And I feel like he can get more than $4 million a year on the open market. So, yes, if they go six times four, I don't know if he's getting the 6 years on the open market, but he could conceivably get more than $24 million on his contract in a shorter period of time on the open market. Like, he could get it in 5 years, let's say, five times five on the open market, you know? So that's...
Yeah, but then again, Arpen, the thing is, next season, if, you know, Marc Bergevin already said yesterday, because of our added depth up front, it wouldn't shock me if Brendan Gallagher did not reach the 30-goal mark next year. Philippe Dano said, I think I've got another offensive dimension to my game. I can bring my production to another level. Well, if that's Bergevin's perception of Gallagher, same goes for his centerman. So if Dano doesn't soar into a bigger or better point producer next year, what sort of ammo will he have on the open market to shop for something that's significantly more than, let's say, $5 million a year? Because right now, as it stands, you were the one the other day to point it out to me when you said, look, Radek Faxa from the Dallas Stars, which defensively is pretty much in the same class as Philippe Dano, same age. He re-signed with the Stars. His number was $3.25 million a year. I'm not sure exactly how long was the contract.
5 years, I think.
5 years, yeah. And he's a guy who roughly... you know, produces 20 points less a season than Dano. So will Dano say those 20 points are worth $2 million more? And will he get that? I'm really not sure. But I don't think that $4 million, a $4 million offer from the Canadiens is going to cut it. Right. So well, that's, you'd have to get closer to five in order to make it happen.
And that, but that's the thing, is that once you do that, then everything Bergevin talked about, you know, the whole not on my watch thing, it becomes in jeopardy. You know, I mean, if I add $5 million to the 2021-22 cap number, that brings them to $70.2 million, which would leave them, what would that, quick math, about $11 million on the cap?
Yeah.
Which they'd have Kotkaniemi and, say, Lekkonen to sign. And Deno's mm-hmm. already signed under that scenario. So that means you're saying goodbye to Tatar, bye to Armia, yeah. which I think is probably yeah. going to happen anyway. Kotkaniemi's probably going to get a bridge deal. I don't think Lekkonen really has, unless he somehow explodes offensively next year, doesn't have much of an arbitration case. So he could, his number could stay pretty reasonable. So let's say best case scenario for the Canadians right now. Okay, let's do this math live on the podcast here. Okay, so let's say Arturi Lekkonen somehow signs a 3-year deal at $3 million a year. Okay, very, very mm-hmm. modest raise. So that's three. Let's say Kotkaniemi gets bridged for 2 years at 3.5 a year. Okay.
Just, sounds right.
So that's 6.5, right? You add yep. that. So 6.5 to the current cap that they have right now on Cap Friendly makes them...
That leaves Dano 4.5.
Yeah, around. So,
yeah.
And the thing is that you don't have enough forwards yet. Like you've signed those three guys, but you have other forward slots that you need to fill. And even if you fill them with entry level contracts still count against the cap, and you need room to accommodate them. So if you add a Paling, like for instance, right now on Cap Friendly, Paling and Evans are not among the forwards that are listed. So that's another, you know, 750 for Evans, whatever. Let's say Paling signs for $1 million a year after this season. So that's almost $2 million right there. Let's say a Yulonen is ready by 21-22. That's another 880,000. So, you know, logistically speaking, that extra $500,000, the difference between $4 million and $4.5 million for Philippe Deneau is actually a big difference if the Canadians want to get everyone under the cap. And that's not even considering the year after, when they have to deal with Suzuki and Romanov. So it's really a tricky situation for Phil Deneau. And basically what I feel like Marc Bergevin is doing, because he keeps using this term, if you want to play in Montreal. Like, you know, when he said it on Tuesday, and in the midst of like all the drama with Jerry Johansson saying contract talks had broken off and blah, blah, blah. When he said, if you want to play in Montreal, like it seemed like he was using Gallagher's loyalty to the Canadians against him. But now, since he used it again yesterday, this seems to be a direct message, as you mentioned, to Philippe Deneau. If you want to play in Montreal, if you want to stay close to home, if you want to stay close to your family, and you want to be a star here, chez toi, well, then you're going to have to get in line. And you're going to have to, yeah. you're going to have to line up with the... And if you want to have a good team, and if you want to win in Montreal... then this is what we are asking you to do. The sacrifice we are asking you to make is this. Is Phil Deneau willing to make that sacrifice? I'm not sure. Knowing the guy, and you know him just as well as I do, he's a proud guy. He knows how valuable he is. He knows how good he is. He knows how unique he is as a player. He's similar to Josh Anderson in the sense that two-way centers like Philippe Deneau do not grow on trees. They're not. Not every team has them. Every team wants one. So he's aware of that. I just feel like that negotiation is going to be very, very tough just because of all the money Marc Bergevin has spent over the last 6 weeks.
Okay, well, again, the devil's advocate. I asked for some time, Your Honor. So roughly your calculation says, okay, we're going to Arturi Lekkonen modest raise to $3 million a year. And by that, those calculations, Deneau probably might be the odd man out. But really, if Arturi Lekkonen is a guy who will move between the third line and fourth line for the foreseeable future on this team, is it really where you choose to invest your $3 million instead of a guy who's your Cadillac insurance policy at center, who could, on a pinch, be your first or second line center, depending on whatever happens to either Kotkaniemi or Suzuki. And he's there to win your faceoffs and play on your PK and all the stuff that Philippe Danault has been doing for the Montreal Canadiens. I think that in just simply in the order of priority, to me, Philippe Danault is more of a priority than Archery Lehkonen.
Yeah, sure, absolutely, and you're right. I mean, that's something that's definitely worth considering. The other thing, although I think they would love to keep Archery Lehkonen, and you know, $3 million is a modest raise. Maybe they could get him at 2.8. I don't know, but I feel like that's a player that they would like to keep. It's really, I think both Brock Bergevin and Claude Julien feel that way. The one option we have not discussed is buying out Paul Byron. And not this year, but next year. So next year, he would have 2 years left on his deal. And here is the buyout cost. I just calculated it quickly in my head. No, not true. I have Cap Friendly open. So in 21...
Thank you, Cap Friendly.
Yes, in 21-22... His buyout, the cap hit on his buyout would be $530,000. And then it would be $1.7 million in 22-23, $1.1 million in 23-24, and $1.1 million in 24-25.
Right.
That, if he's unable to trade Byron, that at its worst year, in 22-23, you're still saving $1.7 million on the cap by doing that. Obviously, you don't have Paul Byron anymore, so that's the trade-off. But if you're desperate for cap room, I mean, 21-22, you'd be saving close to $3 million on the cap. So, and then in 23-24 and 24-25, it would be a $2.3 million savings. So it's an option worth considering. I mean, I still think that Paul Byron... You know, a team like Ottawa would seem to be a perfect fit for Paul Byron. I mean, it just seems like he's done a lot of damage against that team. Pierre Dorion has probably seen him burn his team many times. And it just he's a very useful player. I mean, let's not pretend like Paul Byron's a bad player. He's not. He's just not worth $3.4 million a year anymore. And but I think a player like that could help an up-and-coming team like Ottawa, a team that is still... even despite the signing of Dadonov yesterday, still needs to reach the cap floor, and that's still a consideration for them. Local guy, you know, guy from Ottawa, Pierre Dorion loves that, loves guys who are from Ottawa, and could be a consideration. But if not, if they can't find a trade partner to take Paul Byron's contract, I think the buyout starts to become a really interesting possibility, especially when the alternative is losing Phil Danault on the unrestricted free agent market.
Yeah. Well, I think that next season for Byron will say a lot about his future, because if he remains healthy and somewhat productive, then possibly that there will be a team that will say he is worth the money that he's earning. He might not score 20 again, but with his Swiss Army knife, skill set, I think that he's the sort of guy that, when healthy and in his groove, can provide some pretty good value on a team. Mm-hmm. But just my closing thought on Danault is that I think that at some point he will have to decide if he wants to be like a in a leading role, let's say a comparison with Hollywood. If he wants to be like in a leading role in a B movie, or if he wants to be a good supporting actor, like in an Oscar movie, you know, it's like if we take Quentin Tarantino, for example, and I go back to Reservoir Dogs. Okay. Uh-huh. You had Steve Buscemi, nice career, but he ended up being an amazing supporting actor. And in the same movie, you had Michael Madsen, Mr. Blonde, who thought at some point that he could be the face of some stupid B movies, and his career, you know, just sailed away. Uh-huh. So does Philippe Danault want to be Steve Buscemi, or he wants to be Michael Madsen? I think that that's food for thought. And he can look on Netflix to figure out what his career path is going to be.
"Hello, fellow kids." That's all I think. Whenever I see, whenever I hear Steve Buscemi, that's what I think of. And I think, and that's actually that'll be a good line for Phil Deneau, I think, if he winds up sticking around and he wants to hang out with Suzuki and Cocconeri. "Hello, fellow." Yes. "Hello, fellow kids." okay. All right. Well, let's leave it at that. I think that's a good place to wrap up. And we'll see when we'll be back with the podcast. This has been a roller coaster couple of months.
Wow.
Yeah. It's been really, really heavy. And I'm holding, again, as we said off the bat, I'm holding Marc Bergevin to his word that he's not going to do a whole lot. So if he doesn't do a whole lot, then you might not be hearing from us a whole lot over the next little while, but we'll see. But in the meantime, thank you so much for listening throughout this sort of this roller coaster return to play and bubble and this and that and everything that's gone on the last 6 weeks in the off season. Thanks for reading. Thanks for writing, Marc-Antoine. You've done excellent work on our site, and we'll still be writing. We'll be check us out on The Athletic. And it, as a reminder, if you haven't subscribed to The Athletic and you want to read what we have to write, you can always get a 40% discount that are reserved for Athletic Support listeners by going to theathletic.com/athletic support. That's theathletic.com/athletic support to get 40% off your first year's subscription to The Athletic, where you get not only Marc-Antoine and I, but our army of NHL writers, MLB writers, NBA writers, NFL writers, English Premier League writers, golf writers, you name it, we have it. 40% off, theathletic.com/athletic support.
Thank you for being there, everybody, and see you next time. Bye-bye. Athletic.